Members, we have a new staff person at the table. We're working all of our staff so hard that we've rearranged staff a bit. And so Laura, who has been here, is now focusing on Commerce, which has over 100 bills, I believe. And Owen Wirth has taken over as our committee administrator. And he's on a very fast learning curve here. So we're happy to have him. Have you had a chance, Representative Tice, to take a look at the minutes? Are you willing to move them?
I would move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Any discussion or corrections to the minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. And members, we had one bill that was removed from the agenda today at the author's request. I think you still want to have some conversations and work on it. But we're taking up House File 495, and I will move that bill to get it before us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for allowing me to come back and address House File 495. I think we've talked about the issue of leasing. My name is Mahmoud Noor. I'm representative for District 60B, and I have a testifier who's going to be addressing some of the challenges from the University of Minnesota. So this is the bill that we had already discussed, and I just wanted to turn to the testifier to provide us more information.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is William Dane, D-A-N-E. I'm an attorney with...
It was William Dane, D-A-N-E.
D-A-N-E, yep. And I'm an attorney with the University of Minnesota Student Legal Service. For those of you who aren't familiar, at the University of Minnesota, back in the 1970s, the students created a department at the university called the Student Legal Service to help address students with legal concerns. And in order to fund it, they tax themselves through their student service fee and hire attorneys like me who then work for them in their interests dealing with a lot of issues, a whole range of issues. But one of the big ones, of course, for students is landlord-tenant law. And this year, the students are continuing a process that was started last year when the Minnesota Student Association wanted to bring to the legislature some issues that were of particular importance to students, but do have a broader impact in terms of how they would affect some landlord-tenant situations. I was here for the last hearing, and so I did hear some of the discussion that was going on, and I knew that there were some obvious concerns that were addressed by some of the committee members, and I wanted, if I could, just to address some of these things very very quickly so that you can understand really what the bill is trying to do and what it actually says it's doing.
Yes, I'm so sorry. We understand you were in the room that day and did that.
I didn't get a chance to testify.
You would have been a big help to us, so thank you for being here today.
I hope that's true, Madam Chair. But first of all, the written lease requirement, where we're adding that a written lease must identify the specific unit that the residential tenant will occupy. As you know, there's been an enormous building boom, not just at the University of Minnesota, but throughout the downtowns in the metro area, and it's actually now extending out into other parts of Minnesota as well. And despite this enormous building boom, they still can't keep up with housing. So what's happened in our particular part of the state is that landlords now, in many instances, are collecting deposits and first month's rent for a chance at an apartment. That means they're going to know that certain people aren't going to show up, just like the airlines know certain people won't show up. And so they're not going to sign you an apartment. They're just going to tell you, we'll take your deposit and you're on our list. And the problem is the students got all their money invested in this unit, but they don't know if they're going to get the unit. And it's led to a lot of issues with students being placed in inappropriate units and things like that. So what we're trying to do with this is just have it clear that you need to identify a unit. This is the way most property is rented in the state of Minnesota. As a part of this process, I sit on a Minneapolis committee, the Rental Property Advisory Committee, and I spoke with some of the landlords there about how they rent their properties, and they were kind of incredulous at the notion that you wouldn't identify a unit on a lease. I think it's actually required by the common law on the principle of mutuality, where you have to identify what you're actually renting. And so, and I think the courts have leaned that way as well. But this would give great guidance and make it clear that we're going to have a lease when we know what we're actually renting. So that's all we're trying to do there. The second one, the lease duration notice, where we're asking that the start and the end dates of the lease be clearly stated on the face of the lease. This is one that's caused enormous problems for us in and around the campus, but it's a big problem in other places as well. And what happens is students get 26, 30-page lease documents from landlords who are now multinational corporations. Most of these big buildings are owned by out-of-state concerns. And they rent housing in many different jurisdictions, but they only want one lease. And since we have 50 states with 50 different sets of landlord-tenant laws, these things take on a life of their own. And so students come in all the time with leases that are somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 pages long. And they're supposed to figure out from that exactly what they're renting and how long they're renting it. Well, in most of the leases, the best leases, it states right on the first page how much rent you're paying, when your lease starts, and when it ends. But in some of these leases, that's on page 4 or page 5, and it gets overlooked. And so every year we have to deal with a number of tenants who come to our office in August saying, I just found out I have to move out on the 15th of August, when I thought I was renting till the end of August. And it is very confusing. The genesis of this is that because there are so many landlords competing for the same service people, they want to end these leases early so that they have a better shot at getting the cleaning people and all these other people. So they take back some time. And it wasn't so bad at first. At first, the first few years we saw this, they were taken back 3 days, and then it was a week, and then it was 2 weeks, and now we see 3 weeks as a pretty common thing. And I think the best analogy I could give to you on that is imagine that you go to a grocery store and you buy a dozen eggs once a week. Well, all of a sudden you start going home with your dozen eggs and you open the carton, there's only 11 there. That's going to be upsetting to you because you're not getting the dozen eggs. Well, you go back and you complain and they say, I don't sell you a dozen eggs. I sell you a carton of eggs. It's got 12 places, but I only put 11 eggs in there. So I don't have to make any adjustment. Well, this is essentially what we're dealing with. Students and other renters have lost almost a month of time, but there's no change in the amount that's being charged, and it's still being charged in 12 installments. The way they do that is they oftentimes make you pay rent in August of the coming year, it would be August of 2019, and then they have you move in August 30th. So you pay on August 1st for that day or two, an entire month of rent, and then they let you stay in the following August for 10 or 12 days. But you've lost almost two-thirds of your time in the apartment if you paid the same rent you always were paying. This will not change that. The legislation we brought before you does not say that they cannot do this. If it looks unfair to you on the face of it, it looks unfair to me as well. All this says is you have to let them know that you're doing it. So this is the equivalent of making that grocer put a sign by the egg saying, these cartons contain only 11 eggs, so that you know that. But when you get home, you're not opening up the carton and being surprised. This is all we're trying to do with this. It does not change the finances of the housing situation at all. All it says is, please let these tenants know so that when they get to the end of their tenancy, they're not scrambling, staying in expensive hotels, trying to figure out a way that they can find time to cover 3 weeks of unexpected lack of housing. So that's what we're trying to do there. And that's all the legislation does. It doesn't do more or less. The final thing that I want to address is the time period for notice to quit on a rental increase. This piece of the legislation really just codifies what is already the common law. And I mentioned before this principle of mutuality. So in order to have a contract that everyone agrees is a contract, you have to agree on certain things. To agree that there's a length of the contract, you have to agree how much is being paid or being paid out under the contract, and you have to agree what it is that you're contracting for. All of these things fit within that principle that we're talking about, but this one in particular, because what we're talking about is creating a situation where the notices that must be given are the same for the landlord and the tenant. And so it is not uncommon in many leases to see differing notice periods. The courts have dealt with these for years. The common law principle is there should be mutuality. These things should line up so that you don't have a situation where a tenant must give 60 days notice and the lease, but the landlord could increase the rent on 30 days notice, therefore putting the tenant in a very vulnerable financial position for at least 30 days. So that's what we're dealing with here. So the other thing that comes up, or the other ways the courts interpret this, is the concept of ambiguity in leases. So if you really have two different notice periods, then you have an ambiguity. One party says it's 60 days and the other says it's 30 days. What do the courts say? They say that you must interpret the ambiguity in favor of the party that did not draft the lease. So the non-drafting party gets the benefit of the doubt. It's almost always the tenant, and so it's almost always the tenant who's making the choice between those notice periods. So what happens in a lot of instances is the landlord will put in the lease, I only need to give you 30 days notice on the rent increase. You have to have 60 days, give me 60 days notice to quit. The tenant will give a 30-day notice to quit. What will the court say? They'll say this is ambiguous. We interpret this in favor of the non-drafting party. It's a 30-day notice. What does this statute do? It codifies that. It just says this is the way the law is, and that way you don't have any confusion between landlords and tenants as to what the law actually is. It is very confusing, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm in a unique situation because I can represent my clients at the University of Minnesota. I can go to court with them on all of these kinds of issues, and we can make sure that there are no mistakes made in terms of how the law gets applied. But the average Minnesotan doesn't have that capability, and they don't have the ability to go hire an attorney to go argue about that last month of rent. And so I think this has, of the things we're talking about, maybe the broadest impact. It's certainly not a student housing thing. This applies in a broad way to all rental property in Minnesota. But I just want to really emphasize it doesn't change the law. It just codifies what the law currently is, making it easier for everyone to understand what the law is. So if people have questions, I'd be happy
yes,
to.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Dean. We have some amendments. We do have one other testifier. I did want to say this bill will go to the Judiciary Committee. And the last time, we spent a good bit of time talking about constitutionality, although you're not offering that amendment today, and data privacy, data practices. Judiciary Committee is an ideal committee to deal with both constitutionality issues and data privacy, data practices. So I'm hoping that today we talk more about that kind of the power dynamic between tenant and landlord, and that's what you're trying to address here. Representative Neuer, we have one other testifier. Do you want to take that person first before we go into amendments and discussion?
Yes, please.
So if we could have Mr. Bernberg. And Mr. Bernberg, though, is identified as Homeline, but he tells me he is retired and he's not representing Homeline. He is representing himself this morning as he testifies. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Paul Bernberg. As the chairwoman just got through saying, I retired recently. I represent myself. Yesterday evening, I did my first absolute retirement activity, went to a woodworking class, and I can report
all the fingers
still 10 digits here. I'm going to be very brief, and some of what I was going to say, Mr. Dane has covered better than I could, so I'm going to skip it. I'm a retired attorney. I retired in the end of last year. I spent about 25 years in my practice, pretty much all my practice. This is my second career, doing landlord-tenant law. I was one of five reporters who drafted the recodification, Chapter 504B of the Minnesota statutes, and I was the lead drafter of the Minnesota State Bar Association lease. My first comment concerns Section 4, which I assume is non-controversial, but I figured I should explain it, partly because I'm the one who figured out this problem, which may say something about that I read too much and don't do enough woodworking. Somewhere, what this bill does is it fixes a drafting error. The way that the current statute reads, it says that a lease terminates upon one of two possible events, either the end of the month or the notice that's given by the tenant. But because the word, somebody got careless with his or her right finger and typed two T's. And so it says latter. Latter means the second thing in the sentence and thereby renders the first thing in the sentence completely meaningless. Almost surely the drafters meant later with only one T that means the second thing in time. And so what this amendment does is fix what I would have thought the reviser would have fixed, but apparently the reviser doesn't like to take keys out of legislation, so that's what this is about. On Section 3, which Mr. Dane covered better than I can, I'm just going to make one other comment, which is that, or two comments. One is that it deals with notices to quit as well as notice of rent increase, and a notice to quit is actually the more scary thing for the tenant. You've got a lease that says tenant has to give 2 months' notice, landlord has to give only one. That's the most common example. The tenant's planning 2 months in advance. He can't plan 1 month in advance. So maybe he rents a new place 2 months in advance, gives notice for the 2 months, and then the landlord can give him a 1 month notice. He's basically homeless for a month. Living with his parents, or if he doesn't have parents, he's just homeless. Who knows where he is? So it deals with that. It can deal with a winter notice. Some landlords have a don't move out in winter clause, and this bill would not change that. It would just say if a tenant's stuck here for the winter, the landlord's stuck with the tenant for the winter, Evie Stevie. I want to point out the non-waiver part of the statute bill is to deal with the fact that landlords, residential landlords, write the leases. Tenants have no bargaining power over the little parts of the lease. And if you allow waiver, basically, you might as well throw the bill out. As Mr. Dane said, the courts generally have, I think he said that the bill basically follows what courts have been doing. There's actually an old attorney general lawsuit that got settled. A case called In re Generi from a long time ago, 1981, where the settlement was right along the lines of the bill. The last thing I want to say is the one little thing that concerns me in the bill is the effective date. As the chairwoman mentioned, I think there are constitutional concerns when legislation retroactively imposes rules on leases. It's certainly the conservative way to avoid litigation down the road with people saying, well, this is unfair, unconstitutional, I think is to use the pretty standard language that other legislation in 504B uses, like 504B 177, 161, 178. I'll read 177, and then maybe if the chairman will allow, I'll bring something up to her. 177 says this section is effective at a certain date for leases entered into or renewed on or after that date. That deals with it. It makes it looking forward. If you've got some sort of month-to-month lease that's renewing every month, it deals with that, and it doesn't get into the issue of whether or not we're trying to mess with an old lease that's in the middle of the lease. The chairwoman said that maybe the best place to deal with it is within the Judiciary Committee, but I do think it should be dealt with. And if you'd be so, if it would be appropriate for me, I'd like to bring up a suggestion. Or maybe give it to you.
A page can.
And that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And Mr. Dane, maybe we'll have you come back to the table then, because we'll move into the discussion. And we have we'll deal with that later. Representative Munson has a question and then three amendments. So do you want to have a question first, or you want to proceed with amendments?
Madam Chair, I do have a series of questions based on the testimony that was given today, and particularly the last testifier that just spoke about the winter provision. I believe this is something that I brought up in the last time this bill was brought forward, where I have properties where my tenant can't move out during the wintertime because we have such a limited number of people that would want to rent that property in the wintertime. And so if the lease now says they can't move out between, in January through March, and I think the testifier had said that if this were to apply to that, it would be equal that I couldn't ask them to move out. Well, that means that my tenant wouldn't have to pay rent in December, and I couldn't serve them with notice. I couldn't get them out of the property for over 3 months.
Mr. Dane.
Oh, no. It doesn't mean that because in landlord-tenant law, non-payment of rent is a creature unto itself. And if you bring an eviction action based on non-payment of rent, most other things in terms of the lease are not going to have much applicability to that claim of non-payment of rent. You have the right to stay there, but not if you're not paying rent. And so you would still be able to bring the same action to evict that you would. But what you wouldn't be able to do is say, I think I want to do some remodeling this winter and charge higher rents in the spring or something. You wouldn't be able to move your tenant out in the wintertime either. And so, it's just the same. You get if the same would be true for the tenant who's obligated to stay there through the winter, but not if half of the unit burns down. We can't say you still got to be there. So there are changes that could affect it in other ways. But what we're just talking about is the basic situation. You can have that clause in your lease. This bill is not going to affect it at all. You're going to have the same rights you always had in the wintertime.
Okay. Madam
Chair. So, Representative Munson and members, we do have four bills and a lot of amendments, and we have many testifiers who have come this morning. So I'm going to press pretty hard to stick to very, very concise points so that we can move quickly in respect for all of the people who have been here. So if you want to start with Amendment 129.
Well, Madam Chair, I apologize for taking so much time on this bill, but this is really an important bill that's going to directly increase the cost of rent for so many people in Minnesota. We're talking about an issue that's specific around the University of Minnesota. And I've had many properties that I've owned around the University of Minnesota, and it has an entirely different rental market. And I understand the impacts and the concerns that were brought forward, but this bill impacts all landlord-tenant law across Minnesota, and I think that it deserves a discussion about these details. My other concern is, this Section 3 on page 2 is really, it's taking two things and mingling them together. It's the notice to quit and the notice to rent, to increase rent. This provision is something that we negotiate with tenants to say that they have to give us 60 days notice to move out, and we have to give them 30, and we do that to offset risk so that we don't have properties sitting vacant for months on end trying to find tenants, because sometimes it is difficult to find tenants. And so in order to lower the cost of rent for tenants, we use this provision as flexible. I mean, we can negotiate whatever we want with tenants. This is a contract between landlord and tenant, but this flexibility allows us to lower the cost of rent. I brought this up in the last committee hearing, and I think this is really important. And so I would, Madam Chair, which did you have an amendment you wanted me to hear first?
It's your preference, whichever one you want to move.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I move the A19 amendment.
It's 129.
129, sorry.
I mean, it's... It's the last three numbers that you want to reference.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the Amendment 129.
Representative Munson moves 129. Representative Neuer or Mr. Dane, who would like to give us your...
I'm not sure where you
are. You have the amendments there.
Yes.
What we would quickly like to know is the author's position on the amendment, and then we're going to move fairly quickly to voting because we've had a long discussion of each of these issues. Mr. Dane.
First of all, Representative Munson, I would like to assure you that this bill that's before us right now has been negotiated over the course of 2 years, and Multi-Housing Association, which is the largest representative of landlord groups in the state of Minnesota, has weighed in at every phase on this. No one has ever suggested that there's anything in this legislation that would increase the cost of rent. In fact, I think it may be the case that people were concerned that some landlords, in terms of not this notice provision part, but in terms of the others, are maybe collecting more rent than they ought to because they're taking back time and not compensating for rent. But this is not a bill that was just put together by and for and only for tenants, or only for tenants of the University of Minnesota. Legal Aid weighed in on this. Homeline weighed in on this. These are people who represent broad-based constituencies of tenants. And so I don't believe that, and the MSA, Minnesota Student Association, are the people who really wanted to bring this legislation. If they thought for an instant that it would raise the already enormous cost of housing for students, they would not have brought this bill to you. They're convinced that it won't do that. I haven't seen any evidence that it would raise costs. And so I don't believe that it actually will raise costs. It will take away some flexibility, but in terms of the things that you seem to be most concerned about, like your ability to have a clause that covers your wintertime, these bills won't affect that. As far as having different notices, I talked about that before. Those, I do not believe, will hold up in court of law because the common law basically tells us you have to have mutuality in those notices. So the courts are already interpreting leases the way that this legislation would direct.
Representative Pearson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, specifically, these are leases for under 1 year, the way that you're presenting them to us. So that concept that the common law applies isn't there a big distinction between leases of 1 year and longer and anything under 1 year?
I don't believe that there is. Yeah, a written lease. Now, we do have...
I'm sorry, you don't believe there is? I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but you don't believe there is? You're an attorney, and I guess I want you to state this record that you're saying that a lease under a year is the exact same and treated the same under the common law, or you don't think this is a one-year lease?
I saw both attorneys agreeing to that. Mr. Dane or Mr. Bernberg?
I'll let Mr. Bernberg.
Mr. Bernberg.
I will answer directly. The only difference in leases for residential leases, I think for commercial as well, this is only about residential, is that a lease for more than a year must be written and signed. That's the so-called statute of frauds, which ought to be called the statute of writing down things. But other than that, the same rule of law would apply to a 15-month lease or a 4-month lease. And I agree with Mr. Dane that the judges have routinely come to rulings along the lines of this bill.
So, members, that's before us, A29 to delete Section 3. All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That amendment is defeated. Which one would you like to offer next, Representative Munson?
Madam Chair, I move Amendment 143.
Munson moves Amendment 143. Please explain the amendment.
So this amendment would change Section 3 of this bill to only apply to rent increase so that landlords have to give the same notice period of a rent increase that the tenant, that they would be put in the same playing field. My concern around this is the notice to quit, and you have mentioned in testimony, one of the testifiers mentioned that landlords can just end the lease Making the tenants homeless if the landlords have 30 days to give notice that they're going to evict their, or they're, not renew the lease. Well, the tenants always have the ability to go back to their landlord and renew their lease for the next year. In fact, in the University of Minnesota, tenants can go back and ask to sign up for a lease for the next term. So it's not going, this is basically, this would change Section 3 to only focus on the rent increase. And I do understand where there would be concern where landlord, if the tenant has to give 60 days notice to move out and the landlord only has to give 30 to raise the rent, that they can raise the rent and the tenant would have to pay for that 1 month period, as you spoke of. And I do think that this would, my amendment here would make this fair so that landlord and tenant notice periods would be the same for rent increase and their ability to quit.
Mr. Dane?
Well, the legislation does that. It makes the notice period the same for rent increases. But it needs to be the same for notice to quit as well, and that's that principle of mutuality we talked about before. And what Mr. Bernberg just addressed in terms of the length of the tenancy, whether it's a year-long written lease or it's a lease of a shorter duration, which would then be covered by statute when your notice to quit under the law would be one rental period plus 1 day is what it is if you don't have a written lease. What we're trying to do here is just make it the same, and it makes a lot of sense to have it line up so that your notice periods for your rental increases and your notice periods for your ending of your tenancy are the same. That's the way the courts basically interpret it now, and I mean, I don't know of any instance where the courts have not interpreted that way, but since I haven't been in every courtroom for every case, I'm loath to say that there may not have been a judge that found some reason to defer from that. But that's the common law.
Representative Noor, any further comment to the amendment?
Madam Chair, I think stated right now, this amendment will not be. It's not something that I want the committee to adopt.
Final comment,
Madam Chair. This is really unfortunate because changing these provisions of a lease and restricting landlords' ability to lower the cost of rent by asking the tenant to provide an adequate notice so that they have less vacancy in their properties is going to increase the vacancy rate of housing. We're already talking about having a limited amount of housing in Minnesota, and this bill will create more vacancies, more housing sitting empty, more units sitting empty, and thereby increasing the cost for landlords with no other option but just to raise the cost of rent by 10 or 12% to offset those vacancies. This bill will directly raise the cost of rent in Minnesota. And, Madam Chair, I'd ask for a roll call because I don't want to be on record of having raised the rent in the Housing Committee where our focus is on lowering rent.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll on 143.
Houseman?
No.
Howard?
No.
Heiss? Bierman?
No.
Fisher?
No.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hassan?
No.
Herr?
No.
Hornstein?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Johnson?
Yes.
Juergens? Munson?
Yes.
Pearson?
Aye.
Poppy?
No.
Salk?
No.
Vote is 9-5-1 passing. The amendment fails. Did you want to offer the last amendment?
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw the last amendment.
We're to final passage. We've had good discussion on this. Representative Noor, any closing comments?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. I think this bill will address some of the challenges that I've talked about, making sure that it's not only for the students, but for every lease that exists to allow the tenants to have information of which unit they're renting, when they can offer their quit notice and everything else. So I will ask the committee to pass this bill to the judiciary. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Representative Jurgens, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I get clarification that the final amendment that was not offered that would push out the enactment date, is this still upon enactment?
We have language that I think Mr. Bernberg gave us that we'll pass on to the author to deal with that in the Judiciary Committee. I think that was so we've got language for that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, can I get a roll call on this vote?
Representative Munson wants a roll call on the bill. So I will renew my motion that we re-refer 495 to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. The clerk will take the roll.
Houseman?
Just on final passage. Yes.
Howard?
Yes.
Tice? Bierman?
Yes.
Fisher?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hassan?
Yes.
Herr?
Yes.
Hornstein?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Jurgens?
Yes.
Munson?
No.
Pearson?
No.
Poppy?
Yes.
Sock?
Yes.
Passes 11 to 4. That bill is on its way to the Judiciary Finance. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
The bill. And now we have Representative Hassan's bill. And members, as she's coming forward and any testifiers she may have, this morning, given the theme of the day, I have a book to recommend to all of you as you talk about this particular issue. It is called Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City by Matthew Desmond. He's been in town a couple of times. He spent about a year in Milwaukee spending time with both tenants and landlords and gives a rather grim view. Even in the most desolate areas of American cities, evictions used to be rare, but today most poor renting families are spending more than half of their income on housing, and eviction has become ordinary, especially for single mothers. So it's sort of a grim tale of his discovery. Since then, he has traveled the country and discovered that what he determined in Milwaukee is probably more generally true. So, Representative Hassan, would you like to move your bill?
Before we start, I know everyone is smelling, Madam Chair, the sambusas that are sitting on the desk. If you guys want to just pass it around, that's a treat for the committee.
Now, of course, what she's telling us is this is her first bill before the committee, and there's a tradition that that some observe around here that when a bill author comes with her first bill, that she has a treat for the committee. Thank you. So you're moving. I'll have you move the bill.
So moved.
Representative Hassan moves House File Number 1511. Welcome to the committee. And are you speaking first? Or?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 1511 is primarily about eviction prevention and minimizing the impact of eviction on the future of housing. We're aiming to tackle the impact of eviction. We know that Minnesota is in a housing crisis. Minneapolis is hit the worst, and my district, 62A, is hit the worst. We had the tent city where we had 330 people sleeping outside in the cold because majority of them had some housing related incidents. From 2015 to 2017, there were at least 13,000 evictions filed against Minnesotans per year. An unlawful detainer, rightly or wrongly filed by a landlord, follows a tenant for 7 years, making it nearly impossible for them to find quality and affordable housing in the future. With me, I have experts. I'm not a housing expert, so I will let my experts speak on the subject.
And is the first one Dr. Brittany Lewis?
Yes.
Please, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. First, I want to thank the chair of the committee and the committee as a whole for taking the time to consider this bill. I also want to thank the chair for acknowledging Matthew Desmond's work. Matthew Desmond is a colleague of mine. We have served on a number of panels together, both at our nation's capital and here in the Twin Cities, talking about this pressing issue. My name is Dr. Brittany Lewis. I'm a senior research associate at the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs and a professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. I'm also the principal investigator for the in-depth qualitative study on evictions in Minneapolis. In this study, we use a mixed methodological approach to study evictions in the 55411 and 55412 zip codes in North Minneapolis because 50% of Hennepin County's evictions take place in these two zip codes. Although our current study is focusing on these two zip codes, our quantitative data shows that evictions impact tenants across the state in alarmingly similar ways. It's important to note that when I embarked on this project, I made it very clear to the community and our partners that evictions can be a nuanced issue, despite the fact that it disproportionately impacts single black mothers with children. There are good landlords and there are bad landlords. There are good tenants and there are bad tenants. Our job is not necessarily to assess the righteousness of a person's character, but to rather identify what policies and practices are making it difficult for both landlords and tenants to be successful while drawing attention to the ways which systemic processes inhibit good practices across the state of Minnesota. Although my time with you today is short, I'm more than willing, if asked, to share any in-depth stories that you might find helpful as you further understand the severity of the issue at hand. To date, I have interviewed 32 landlords and 68 tenants, and we're expanding our eviction study to the outer ring suburbs. We are only one of two states in the country where you do not have to have a hearing before an unlawful detainer is placed on your record. In my interviews with tenants, the most common misconception is that they can appear in court, arrange a settlement agreement, or argue their case in court and win, and the unlawful detainer will no longer be on their record. That is the most common misconception that most, if not all, the tenants I interview held. And in many of my interviews, folks didn't learn that was not the case until I informed them. This is simply not true. There is an education gap here, which has had grave impact on tenants' ability to secure safe and affordable housing. 25% of the tenants I have interviewed were still living in the place that they were evicted from and had resigned to staying in a property where they felt unsafe and even exploited, but could not leave as a result of receiving multiple unlawful detainers, even if they had settled their debts. All of the tenants that I interviewed described an unlawful detainer as a barrier to attaining safe and affordable housing to the point where close to half were forced into homelessness. I interviewed a number of folks that were sleeping in their cars, couch hopping, and were hopping in and out of shelter because of the realities that unlawful detainer placed on them both financially and the stigma that went along with it. Another group of tenants that we interviewed were asked by landlords to pay double deposits because they were determined to be risky tenants. Even for those folks that made settlement agreements, fulfilled that agreement, and were unaware that they had to go back to court, file a fee to seek expungement. That is extreme financial hardship for families out of the working poor. This is who this impacts the most. In my expert opinion, the Eviction Expungement Reform Bill is ideal for tenants and landlords. It gives judges and referees the discretion needed to order expungements if the case is dismissed, a tenant wins, or a settlement agreement is made, and if the tenant fulfills those terms. It also ensures that landlords have accurate information on their incoming tenants and aren't adding any additional hardships, such as double deposits, to tenants that would be successful and who would otherwise apply. I think this is a pressing issue that we should all care about, you know, across the state of Minnesota. It's impacting landlords' abilities to secure reliable tenants who are fulfilling their agreements. It's impacting tenants' abilities to choose to move outside of unsafe conditions. It's forcing a lot of our tenants into homelessness because of a lack of education. Thank you.
And Mr. Bernberg has indicated he doesn't need to testify on this, so we'll move to the next testifier at the table. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Larry McDonough. My title is I'm pro bono counsel at Dorsey & Whitney. It's kind of a fancy title. What it means is I direct the free legal assistance programs to low-income persons at the law firm. Our clients include low-income tenants, but it also includes low-income landlords and small nonprofit landlords. I've been a housing attorney for about 35 years. Probably got about over 10,000 former clients of both landlords and tenants. I was a member of the commission that proposed housing courts back in 1988-1989, and I guess this is a little bit of a reunion today because I was also in that same group with Paul Bernberg that transferred statutes into 504B from previous statutes. I've been involved with most landlord-tenant statutes since about 1986 in one form or another, housing court rules. Side note is I was a professor for Todd Littlequist from multi-housing when he was in my housing clinic. That was a little bit time ago. But I've also been an off-and-on landlord for the last 30 years. I'm not presently a landlord, but I've had single-family properties from time to time, and so I've seen this from a landlord perspective as well. So what we're talking about today is amendments to the expungement statute, and I want to just briefly explain what the statute does now, what the proposal would do, and what I think the effects would be. So currently we have mandatory expungement in a very narrow swath of cases involving mortgage foreclosures and contract for deed cancellations in very limited circumstances. If the occupant moved out before the eviction was filed, or if the tenant occupant didn't receive the proper notice. So that's the only form of mandatory expungement we have right now. And we have discretionary expungement also in a fairly narrow category. It has to be done by a motion by the tenant. And it's limited to situations where the landlord's case was sufficiently without a basis in fact or law. So in other words, there's something wrong with the landlord's case that's significant, that is clearly in the interest of justice, and the interests of justice are not outweighed by the public's the interests are not outweighed by the public interest. And so we have fairly narrow expungement right now. And the effect of that is that there are many thousands of eviction cases that stay on the court records for years. And the representative, when she was talking about the 7 years, that's the 7-year limit is just on tenant screening agencies. I worked on an expungement, and the court records stay on the court's database until forever. Right, and so in the last year I worked on an expungement case from the year 2000 where the physical court files didn't even exist anymore. So all we had was like a computer screen that said this case has been filed and had been settled, and that was it. Tenant didn't really remember much about it. A landlord didn't come to oppose. We were able to get an expungement of it under the court's inherent authority, but we would not have been able to get an expungement under the statute because we could not identify anything that the landlord might have done wrong in that case 18 years ago. There's a filing fee for motions that sometimes can be waived, but the filing fee is $300 for folks that are not of the lowest incomes. Many landlords use evictions as essentially a flag, a kind of a red flag, to say that I'm not going to look at you because you have this eviction on the record. So the tenant never gets the opportunity to say why that eviction doesn't show who I am today because they've been flagged out. And the effect of this is that there are a lot of tenants that are homeless. There are a lot of tenants that are prospective tenants that are homeless, or they're staying in shelters at the cost to the county. And, you know, I think all of us know that there have been studies out there that says that housing instability affects not only the adults, but affects the kids. If kids are moving around from one place to another or they're staying in a shelter, they're not going to do as well in school. And I just want to give an example of a case of how, you know, put really a fine line on this. I had a case a few years ago. It was actually in the housing clinic that I ran at the U, where there were these two young women from Cold Spring, and they were both college students. And there, some of you might recall, there was a school shooting in Cold Spring, and it killed, I think, a senior and a junior. And these two young women were friends of the senior. And they were going back and forth to Cold Spring, and each one thought the other had paid the rent, and neither had. And the landlord hadn't done anything wrong. The landlord just said, well, you know, these gals are usually pretty on the ball, so maybe they've taken off, so he files an eviction case. They come back, and they settle the eviction case because, and they were really apologetic. They paid all the landlord's fees and costs and everything. They stayed through the remainder of their tenancy, and they moved out. And they didn't know at the time that they had an eviction on the record until they applied for another place. So they came to the clinic to try to get an expungement. We did a motion for expungement. The expungement was denied under the statute because the landlord hadn't done anything wrong, okay? And it didn't fit mandatory expungement. We did an appeal, and we were able to get a judge to expunge it under the court's inherent power, which looks a little broader. But that gives you an idea how the current statute really limits expungement to a very small swath of cases. So what does this 1511 do? What adds a number of categories to mandatory? In Section 2, if the defendant prevails in the merits, if the court dismisses the case, if the parties have an agreement to expungement, and the tenant fulfills that agreement. And Amendment H1511A1 would add to mandatory if the court finds the eviction was 3 years old. So the bill as presented doesn't have that. It has that in discretionary. The amendment H1511A1 would add that to mandatory.
If that's offered, we might have you back to make
yep.
that point.
Yep. So Section 1 changes discretionary, and it adds in the component that the eviction case is no longer a reasonable predictor of future tenant behavior. And as a former landlord, that's always what I was most interested in, is what is in this tenant's record that tells me if the tenant didn't have a non-payment of rent issue 5 years ago, but they don't have non-payment of rent issues now, that case from 5 years ago, from my vantage point as a former landlord, was not predictive. That's what I was interested in when I would screen tenants, is what is predictive. Is this tenant going to pay the rent? Are they going to follow the rules? Are they going to bug their neighbors or not? That's what I wanted to know. Okay. And then
we have three more testifiers.
I'm sorry.
And so I don't know if you have significantly more. You'll probably be speaking some amendments too.
I think I could stop at this point, and then I could be a resource to answer questions.
Okay. Representative Hassan, we've had a few other people ask to testify, so I think I'm going to take those three testifiers very quickly, if we could. Cecil Smith, Cornerstone Property Professionals. And then we also have, maybe you could, where's the edit? Bernadette Hornig from Hornig Companies, if both of you would come up. And then we have a third testifier. We're just going to have to ask you to be very brief, however, because we've got a couple more bills and lots of amendments. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I am the managing broker and principal of Cornerstone Property Professionals. I'm the past board chair of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I'm glad that we're talking about Matt Desmond's research. According to Matt Desmond's research at the Eviction Lab, Minnesota's eviction filing rate ranks nationally at 44th. There are other studies that have us as low as 49th for eviction filings in the country. And in those statistics of Mr. Desmond, only 25% of the residents were actually displaced. The 2016 eviction study by the City of Minneapolis made clear that we have a problem, particularly in two zip codes. Primarily, in that study, they found that eviction filings were for non-payment of rent, 93% of all cases. And disappointingly, the most frequent filers...
I'm hoping you're speaking to the bill.
Yes, I'm talking about...
Very pointedly to the bill, sir.
To the bill. So this legislation that's before us seeks to reduce the public right to know eviction records, because we have a limited number of evictions. They are significant. They have a significant impact on residents, and they are significant for owners and managers to know and understand the prior rental history of a resident. There's work to be done to reduce evictions. This doesn't do that work. There's work that could be done to aid emergency assistance to residents. This bill doesn't do that. We need to curb predatory practices of landlords who use the eviction process and court filings to harass and menace their residents. I'm concerned that this bill would in actual fact provide cover for them, that this, without intention, could become the Predatory Landlord Protection Act, because we will not know. The statistics will not be there for us to understand who is filing, how they're filing, where they're filing, against whom are they filing, because the public records will be expunged. A functional market needs this information. As industry leader and professional, we need to have this information in order to have a functional market in Minnesota. I would also like to point out that Subdivision 3, the break lease clause, makes owners vulnerable to renters who choose not to pay their rent and then rent another apartment, effectively breaking their lease. Meanwhile, the owner of the new apartment that they're seeking will have no idea that a legal action has commenced against that resident in order to regain custody of the unit. The new manager during that background check will have no information as the eviction is still underway. This legislation will have significant unintended consequences. I'd urge this committee to investigate and examine eviction prevention solutions and leave the public records alone.
Ms. Hornig, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Bernadette Hornig. I'm a third-generation owner-manager. We have properties across the state, about 4,000 apartments, and I do look at tenant applications every single day. And I'll tell you why I think we need this data and why I think this bill is ill-advised. And as Mr. Smith and others indicated, I think there are other solutions to get at the problem of people who have bad data following them and preventing them from obtaining the housing that they desire. As Ms. Lewis indicated, one of the things that we do when we look at tenant applications is assess the risk. At least is a business contract between us and the tenants. For most people, their rent is their number one expense in their life, and we need to understand if the person who's signing that contract can fulfill it. That's what we do. And we need that rent in order to pay our mortgages, pay our taxes, pay our utilities. If people don't pay the rent, we can't pay our employees. We can't be a functional, productive business in the state of Minnesota, which is important to us. And we want to fill our apartments. I think another misconception in the way these bills are framed is that, you know, we're looking to screen people out. We're looking to screen people in. And so we want to have good data so that we can get people into housing, stable housing. It's good for everybody. It's good for our communities. We live where we rent our apartments. I understand the impulse not to want to have bad data follow tenants around. And I understand that, but I think that, as Mr. Smith said, I think this will protect bad actors. You can get your UD expunged. I know that there are hurdles to that, but we receive motions for expungement from past tenants all the time. I'd say most landlords don't protest them, and people are able to get them expunged. I think that providing a more streamlined process would help, but I don't think 3 years of just having it wipe away without any consequence is the answer to that. I think there's more we can do to prevent evictions, such as expediting EA, providing support to tenants, and legal representation like some communities are doing. But I don't think that this will help anything with housing stability. If you're going to get evicted, if you're in a position where you can't afford your rent, whether you had an eviction 3 years ago isn't going to help you. And I also think that we do need to know, as Mr. Smith said, if someone has particularly pending action against them when they're applying for an apartment. I think that it's completely one-sided, and it's not going to do anything for the tenants or the landlords in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. And Metric Giles, is Metric Giles in the audience? We had a request. I think I don't see him. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Carolyn Brown with Community Stabilization Project on behalf of Metro Giles.
Carolyn?
Brown.
Brown. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you. I'm here as a housing advocate, and I want to speak to the piece where there are good landlords, bad tenants.
And very, very.
Okay, and bad tenants as well. But tenants are now out here homeless and being hindered on the fact about this expungement piece. They go to court, they make a settlement, and they don't know that they have to go back to have this record actually expunged off their record. We have some tenants that has paid the debt off, but the record is still there. We are asking that this bill take place so that these tenants cannot be homeless. Right now, we have over 100 individuals on the waiting list just to get into shelter. We have over 100 families sleeping in hotels because of this eviction record. We are asking that this bill be supported today. Thank you.
We've concluded the testifiers, I think.
Madam Chair, there's one more person that wants to testify, and they will be very brief. Jamila? Welcome. We'll be just 2 minutes.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jamila Mami, and I am a tenant here at Mazi Property here in St. Paul, Minnesota. I moved into my apartment in September, and ever since I moved in, we've had, I tried to reach out to my landlord and tried to tell them basically to come and fix some of the stuff that are basically missing. And then they said that they won't be able to fix it because they told me at the beginning that they won't be able to fix it, but they will try to remove the carpet. And then when they removed the carpet, they actually didn't clean it really good. So I called the fire department. They came and they said that actually the carpet is not the only problem, that you don't have carbon monoxide detector. And then I tried to reach out to my landlord, and then the next email that I received from them was, if you don't pay your bill, you will be evicted, and it will be on your record for 10 years. To me, that was really scary because I don't want something like that on my record, because I've always tried to be a good citizen, and I feel like having that on your record will hinder you from a lot of stuff. And today I ask landlords and also all of you here to please support your bill, support this bill, because I'm a good tenant and I try to abide by the rule established by the landlord and also by the city. But at the same time, I should have that right, the right at least to live in a place that is habitable by human, a place that is safe, a place that where I go home at the end of the day that I feel comfortable to be in, not a place where when I go home, I always think about, oh my God, what is going on? I really can't stay here, because I wish I could show you guys a picture today, but I don't have a picture with me right now, but it's not really habitable. And I have nieces and nephews that stay with me under the age of 5 sometimes, and it's not a place that I want to bring them into. And I ask all of you today to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Hassan, I think we'll have Dr. Lewis and Mr. McDonough come back to the table. We have a few questions, and I think they might have been to the earlier testifier. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of time, I'll be brief, and I just wanted to thank Representative Hassan for bringing this bill forward, and particularly to Dr. Lewis for the testimony and grounding us in the experiences of Minnesotans, tenants that are having to navigate this system. And my brief question, you mentioned that the concentration of the challenges in terms regionally in Minnesota or in Minneapolis, where you focused your study and where we're seeing a lot of this issue. Would you comment on sort of the racial equity piece of this? I mean, it seems like that is an important dynamic here, is that we have a system in place that is delivering. Through no fault, this is just a built-up system that's delivering outcomes that are having disparate impacts in communities. Okay. I just wonder if you comment on that part of your research.
100%. Thank you, committee member, for the question. For those of us who don't know, our housing history across the nation and in inner city urban areas are writ with
racially discriminatory policies and practices that make your job a lot challenging because you're kind of having to redress some of that work. That is what we're experiencing here. In North Minneapolis, I interviewed 32 landlords, and most of all the landlords said they bought it because it was cheap, and they did it at the same years. We tracked this work, right? And they bought it for investment. And what's unique about North Minneapolis is it's mostly single-family homes and duplexes. There are no large multiplexes in North. So you have owners that own 3 up to 50, right? And these are mom-and-pop folks just like me and you who have regular jobs and no time, okay? And I would argue that the folks disproportionately impacted by this issue are single black mothers with children. The only criteria for our study was, did you get evicted in the last 3 years in 2 zip codes? And it's not a surprise that 80% of those folks or more were black, right, and had children. And what I also know, as my other testifier noted, in those interviews, they would bring their children. So although we were not interviewing children, almost half of those interviews, there were children within them because they had nowhere else to go. So although I was not interviewing children and could not legally do that, everything that these families were experiencing, the children were as well. And the levels of displacement, the couch hopping, the homelessness, and the ways in which folks are making ends meet are disproportionately impacting low-income folks of color. And there's no getting around that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to, I appreciate that testimony, and I see this bill as just looking at the overall system. It's not about singling out bad actors, good actors.
Right.
It's looking at a system in place that is having a significant impact and positive change, and I thank Representative Hassan for bringing it forward.
I have Representative Tyson, Representative Jerkins, and then we'll move to Representative Munson's amendments. Representative Tyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hassan. As a landlord in St. Cloud, I'm looking at this and going, man, this is bad. It's going to be bad for us. I'm very much one that if you have an issue, let me know, and we'll work with you on it. And we have been doing that. And we have 5 rentals right now. We have 5 homes, and 2 of the 5 are women of color with children. And we have worked with them a lot. Because it's expensive to evict them. It's expensive, and then it costs me time and money to go to court to have them evicted. We had a couple that moved in May, and we evicted them in August. I can't tell you how much money it cost us. It was a dumpster full of crap. Children that we had called about because we were really concerned about what was happening in the home. And these are not just out of the norm. But every time we have to evict, it also costs us a lot of money. So it's not something we actively want to do. The bill also protects bad actors because we're not getting data that says exactly what we just heard. We're not getting that data that somebody is really not participating well in the program. And that is a concern. I just want to make very clear that a lot of us feel like this is a way to increase costs. We need to screen our folks. It's important. We're giving them a property we own to use as their home. And a lot of times, we have a lot of good people. Yes, we all have bad actors. But it just feels like I'm getting, and I can't tell you how many times I get so angry about the new laws that come in that really change how we have to do our rentals because of somebody that did something bad.
Who would like to respond to that? Mr. McDonough?
I can respond, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm presently not a landlord. I was last a landlord I think my last unit was in 2014. And I have done evictions. I know the cost of it. But this bill does not change the fact that landlords don't have to rent to anyone. You still screen. It does change the data that's available to you through the court system, right? But when, you know, I was a landlord long enough ago where we didn't have tenant screening agencies, and we didn't have public court records on computers and stuff, and I did the screening the way, you know, you get references, you call the references, you figure out if the references are legit, and that's the same kind of screening I did up until my last property. So you still have the ability to get data, but you're right, this bill does change the public aspect of that data.
Representative Jurgens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tice touched on one of the issues that I – so I'll skip that, having to do with being able to use this information and weeding out the bad actors. My concern with this is that is it fair to the other tenants in a building if all the information wasn't available to the landlords, so they accepted a tenant that then causes disruptions or whatever it might be for the other tenants in the building? And sometimes in this body we have solutions that for where there isn't necessarily a widespread problem. I recognize that there may be a problem in a couple of zip codes, but perhaps we should find a way to deal with those zip codes. And I believe it was Mr. Smith that testified today, if maybe somebody else has information, but where does Minnesota rank nationally as far as evictions, or the city of Minneapolis or the city of St. Paul? Where do we rank nationally? Because my understanding is that we're far below the national averages for a number of evictions to begin with. So if somebody could help clarify that, I would appreciate it.
Brief response.
So I want to try to address both of your comments. I really try not to get into this good or bad debate because it leads us absolutely nowhere. I think you're right. Evictions cost a great deal of money, and all landlords I interviewed shared that. And many try to avoid evictions. But this bill in particular aims to decrease it from 10 years to 3. It also aims to allow judges and referees who are encountering this in housing court, which I'd argue looks more like eviction court, the opportunity to use a discretion to decide if an expungement is necessary in a particular case, so that a tenant who is a working poor does not then have to refile again to come back to court to do work that could be done right in that setting. As far as our national eviction rates, Matthew Desmond is, as I'm sure you know, he's released his evictions lab data. And on a lot of scales, it's very subjective because it presumes the folks that have been willing to give them their state records, they haven't been able to get close to half the states to agree to that. So if you want to look at national rankings, right now the best we have is Matthew Desmond's work, which is barely finished and very inconclusive in my humble opinion. I believe he's doing the best he can to try to ensure that most states report, but less than half have. So any number that's given to you is extremely subjective at this stage in the game. As I noted before, we are one of only two states in the country where a landlord can file an eviction before a court hearing and it's already on a tenant's record. That means a tenant has a UD even before they have appeared in front of a judge. I just don't think that's right.
Thank you. Representative Pearson, and then we're going to move to amendments.
Madam Chair,
you have a follow-up?
Well, I didn't really hear an answer. I wonder if somebody else, and I understand the access to not, is there, if there's somebody else that could maybe provide some ranking information where Minnesota ranks?
We need a name. Can you pass up a name? If you want to testify, it's always helpful to have a page bring us a name. What is it? John Reynolds. Did any of the testifiers want to have a response?
John Reynolds with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Just really briefly to Representative Juergen's question, according to Matthew Desmond's Eviction Lab, Minnesota is one of the 30 or so states where they feel they have concrete data so that they can make accurate assumptions. There's about 20 other states where they had more difficulty tracking down eviction data. So one of the ironies is he's able to do that work because he has access to eviction data. So the city of Minneapolis, among large U.S. cities, has the 201st lowest eviction rate in the country. It's about 0.8% statewide.
Unfortunately, they're just all in those two neighborhoods. So there's the dilemma that they're trying to give us.
Folks have mentioned
Minneapolis has a lot of residents, and unfortunately, that number of evictions is centered in two neighborhoods.
Thank you.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question I have goes to the implementation of the discretionary expungement. This wording, and again, hopefully the attorneys in the room might help me out. It's kind of implying that the court is always going to be analyzing all past eviction cases. And it's eliminating the opportunity for a motion to be made by a defendant. So if they aren't getting their discretionary expungement, it seems like only if the court makes the finding that the eviction case court file is no longer a reasonable predictor of future tenant behavior, I guess in, you know, like the eviction's been filed, and you know, we could be 18 months after the eviction is filed. Is the court obligated to continually screen and try to anticipate whether or not the eviction case is still a predictor? Because it's always changing, it's always ongoing, and as I read the statute, the person who was evicted can't even file that to the court. It's only the court's discretion, and they're supposed to be monitoring this.
To Mr. McDonough?
Yes, I can speak to that, Representative.
Very, very briefly.
Yeah.
I
the change in the statute.
I wanted to get to this, at least the Howard bill, but
right.
We're pressing.
Okay. So the change in that aspect of the statute is right now the court doesn't have the power to do the expungement unless the tenant asks for it. And so by eliminating the upon the motion of the defendant means the court can do it on its own motion. Now, there isn't anything in here that requires the court to continually monitor this. And so I think, in effect, what's going to happen is the court, maybe at the end of an eviction hearing, might make a decision right then that I'm going to expunge this case for these reasons. But more likely what's going to happen, I think, is a tenant is going to do a motion. But this doesn't preclude tenants from doing motions. It just takes the limitation on the court away.
Representative Hassan, I failed to have you move the author's amendment to get the bill as order you want. Would you please move that amendment to A1?
Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
And that just gets the bill before us as the author intended. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, that author's amendment is adopted. Sorry about the delay. We're going to move to Representative Munson. You have two amendments. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Herr had a question yet.
I actually just wanted to make a quick comment, and maybe this is my lack of understanding of this, but I'm just curious. So, like, if you declare bankruptcy, it gets deleted off of your record in 7 years from the date of filing, even if you only pay some part of it, and within 10 years, it gets completely expunged from your record. And I guess I don't understand when I think about who we're sort of, who this is sort of targeted at, is that, like, I mean, if I can completely get rid of all my debt by declaring bankruptcy, that's off in 10 years. I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around the fact that if you get evicted, that's on your record for 10 years. And to me, that just seems like a huge punishment for something that we have other things already showing that when something really big happens, they only have 10 years as well on their record. So I just maybe wanted to just point that out. Maybe I'm not understanding some of these things and why it's set this way, and I don't know if there is an answer, but maybe it's a hypothetical. So I just wanted to, you know, put that out there.
Representative Munson, you have two amendments.
Hey, Madam Chair, I would like to move Amendment 128.
Very quickly.
This amendment removes the clause in Section 3 that would prevent this data from being non-public. So this is what we spoke to, we had many testifiers speak to on removing this from the public record, removing eviction notices from the public record. That my concern as a landlord is that I want to be able to choose tenants that are a good fit for properties and negotiate their security deposit and rent.
Munson,
yep.
Counsel points out that you seem to be describing 134 instead of...
Oh, I'm sorry. I had the wrong amendment here. What do we...
So we're now on 134.
134.
Exactly.
Okay, you're right, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. There we go. 134. So this removes the Section 3 on page 2 lines... Section 3, I guess it's described as. As a landlord, I want to make sure that I find a good tenant from a property, and based on their rental history and risk of not paying rent, I will negotiate their rent and their security deposit and make other reasonable accommodations so that it works for them. And I call previous landlords to get their rental history and references. And which is recently, it's been only rental history that they give me. And if there's a landlord that is currently evicting this tenant, they really don't have an incentive to tell me that they're evicting this tenant. and because they would rather the tenant move and then have to deal with the lengthy eviction. And so this information being public helps me figure out what's going to work with that tenant. And believe me, I've taken in tenants that have had previous evictions, and after the housing crisis a decade ago, there were a lot of tenants that lost their home in foreclosure. And that is also a big red flag for landlords to address and figure out what's going to work best for them. Maybe do some more research on that tenant. Maybe ask for a larger security deposit. Maybe double check their employment and history and income to make sure that person's situation has changed and that they're going to be a good fit for the property. And that's how we manage to keep our expenses low and keep our and thereby reducing our rent. So this provision is frightening that you're going to take this visibility away from us. And then somebody testified earlier about 80% of the people that in your survey that had an eviction were people of color or black people. And this is a concern. If you take this away, this tool away for us to make a financial decision based on their risk as a tenant, then a lot of bad apples out there are going to be discriminatory towards a certain class of people based on assumptions. And that's dangerous, too.
Mr. McDonough, or who would like to respond? I would urge you to be very brief.
Well, all I would say is that this doesn't preclude classic tenant screening. And granted, I'm not the biggest landlord in the world. I'm pretty small in the world in terms of landlords, but I never ran into a circumstance where a landlord didn't give me a reference who had a pending eviction case. So there still is the same way that people have been screening since the beginning of time.
Representative Hassan, do you want to?
I just want to say we respectfully reject this amendment.
Madam Chair, if I could ask one more question or bring it up to the members of the committee. This provision goes beyond housing. In addition to being a landlord for 25 years, I've also worked in the financial services industry. And we do checks on employees to see their financial situation. If you're being evicted from your home, is a red flag for the financial industry, the regulatory industry, to do checks on their employees to make sure they're not embezzling money. It's a very important tool that we have in Minnesota to keep checks on employees to make sure that they're not a risk of embezzling money in companies. This is something that goes beyond housing, but this is information that should be public so that we understand people's financial situation. So I think this is an important amendment, and I urge members to adopt it.
Dr. Lewis.
I think this committee has to make a value judgment here, because what this provision allows is for a tenant to have the right to be heard before a final judgment appears on their record. This is a value judgment, as far as I'm concerned, about who has the rights when and where. Second, to discrimination against black people. I interviewed 32 landlords, all of whom were white, except two black female property owners, who said to me that they actively discriminate. Some actively told me they discriminate against black people, and they don't need that provision to do that. So let me tell you that discrimination goes beyond this provision, and folks sitting across a black academic will tell me to my face that they do that. So I heed the point, but note that this won't stop, prevent, or expand any discrimination that's already been happening and persists in this state and across the nation in urban communities where folks of color are being actively exploited and discriminated against.
Members, I am told by some members of the public that the legislature has not heard for a number of years any tenants' rights or tenants' protections legislation at all, and you can get some sense of why today. We really have a basic discussion of a power struggle, and where does the power lie, and is there an imbalance in that power in our system? And I think you feel some of that this morning. We have the 134 amendment before us. Representative Hassan has advised that she would prefer this not be added to the bill. All in favor?
Madam Chair, can I ask for a roll call?
A roll call on 134 has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Houseman?
No.
Howard?
No.
Tice?
Yes.
Bierman?
Nope.
Fisher?
Nope.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hassan?
No.
Herr?
No.
Hornstein?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Juergens?
Yes.
Munson?
Yes.
Pearson?
Yes.
Poppy? Saw?
No.
Amendment fails 8-6. And Representative Munson, you have one more.
Madam Chair, this is this has to do with line 2.7. I'm sorry, the motion, is this the 128? Yep. Madam Chair, I move amendment 128. And this would delete line 2.7 on page 2 that reads, if the court dismissed the plaintiff's complaint for any reason. Mm-hmm. I believe there's instances that the landlord that doesn't show up for a case and it's dismissed, that it gets to be expunged from the record, even though they've proven it to be true before. I have concerns over this line, and I'll take questions from the testifiers if they have any.
Yeah, I can speak to that.
Very briefly.
Yeah. So if a case is dismissed, the landlord hasn't proven it. The landlord's made an allegation in a complaint, but a court has dismissed that, and it could be for something procedural or it could be something that's not procedural. And so the reason to have this here is that, from my vantage point as a landlord, that eviction case isn't a predictor of anything to me because there's been an allegation, but nothing's been proven.
Okay, that Representative Hassan.
Madam Chair, we oppose this amendment.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, I would speak in favor of this amendment because it could be the fourth hearing on the same eviction notice that, where it's time after time after time. And I'll explain the eviction process later because I've served many of these eviction notices on the same person multiple times. But it could be the fourth notice where they finally moved out just before the court hearing. That's why it was dismissed at that time because they finally left the property.
That amendment is before us. Representative Hassan has indicated a desire not to have this amendment added. The clerk will take the roll. It was a roll call requested. No roll call.
Madam Chair.
No roll call. All in favor of this amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That amendment is not adopted. The bill is before us. Do you have any final comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just want to remind folks that this bill is not about protecting bad behavior or rewarding bad behavior. Minnesota has the worst disparities in the nation when it comes to housing, when it comes to wealth creation, when it comes to education. We know that. What this bill does is that it just gives tenants the right to have a voice. I don't know if any of you guys have ever been to housing court. Mm. I have been to housing court, and it feels like that the tenants don't have a voice. It feels like that sometimes tenants will get the notice, and they won't. I know a case where a tenant got a notice. They don't speak English or they don't read and write. A week later, they asked somebody to read that notice, and it was a week later, and then they've been evicted. So this gives tenants a voice. And if you are a good landlord, you have nothing to worry about. This doesn't change the process that we have. It just gives tenants a protection and a right and a voice. And I know your study talks about only 2 zip codes, but I live in South Minneapolis, and I can guarantee you the numbers are the same, if not more. So please support this bill.
Representative Pearson?
I know we're really short on time. The fact that the A1 wasn't moved right away has me now scrambling to figure out what this means on line 1.11, that it says then the court file remains a non-public record. So then at that point, who does have access to that? We're talking about Section 3, Subsection 3, the non-public record. There's maybe too many double negatives there for me to track, and the A1 being moved so late, I didn't realize this was not the author. I thought it was not the author's amendment, so I was trying to figure out what we're saying here, because it looks like it's saying the evictions won't be public record moving forward. And I don't think that's what you're trying to accomplish, but if it is, then I adamantly oppose this bill the underlying bill is completely flawed, because then what's the point? And to Representative Hurst's point earlier about bankruptcies, they actually do remain in the public record for 10 years. It's just banks at that point pass over them and kind of consider them not to be necessary. But it's still public record, and it's still available for a landlord to see that someone had a bankruptcy 10 years ago, but they'll probably rent to them anyway. Same thing with evictions. But here, I feel like we're saying it's then the court files remain a non-public record is added at the end of that line. Can I get an explanation of what that means?
We're working on it.
I didn't write this.
Should we get Representative Johnson's question out too?
Chair Hausman, I don't have a question. I have more of a comment. And I understand what Representative Hassan is trying to do here. But the bill protects the bad actors, bad landlords, the bad tenants. It doesn't help the good ones. It protects the bad ones. A landlord needs to do their due diligence when they're renting, just like the tenant should do their due diligence when they're looking for a place to rent. And these court records can show things. You can look up the name of the business and see how many eviction notices they filed. Just as the landlord can look to see how many was filed against the person looking to rent that facility. Now, I've done, I don't know how many hundreds of evictions. I hated doing them, but it was my job. And if you actually know the process for eviction, it starts with the owner of the property sending a certified letter. You're behind in your rent. Please take care of this before I have to start the eviction process. If it's ignored, it files a petition with the court to start the process. And law enforcement, usually the sheriff's office, has to serve that paper. It is an action in court. It is filed. It's on the record because it starts the court process. Gives them 30 days to take care of the problem. If it's not taken care of, they file again to continue that order. We serve a paper. They have 14 days to appear in court. They appear in court. They have 30 days to, if they lose, they have 30 days to move out. If they don't move out, they file again, start the process. We serve the paper. They have 7 days to appear in court, and they have 2 weeks to move out. They don't move out. File the paperwork, serve the paper. They have 7 days to move, have court. They have within 7 days, and at some point, 6 to 9 months later, and I've actually done this 5 times where I knock on the door and physically remove somebody from the property. I think what we need to do instead of doing this is look at our eviction process to make sure it's cleaned up. And I think that's where you need to look at is cleaning up our eviction process. Because overall, this system that we have in the court records and what you're doing here is good, but we need to look at how the eviction process works so it doesn't take 6 to 9 months to remove somebody who's failing to pay their rent, causing problems, harassing neighbors in the complex or in their apartment buildings, to protect the good tenants.
Representative Hassan renews her motion that House File 1511 be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law
Madam
Division.
Chair. Can I get a roll call then? Because we don't have an answer to this question.
We can get
No one's addressed it.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Answer.
Houseman.
Yes.
Can we answer?
Howard.
Yes.
Tice.
No.
Bierman.
Yes.
Fisher.
Yes.
Gunther.
Pass.
Hassan.
Yes.
Herr.
Yes.
Hornstein.
Yes.
Johnson.
No.
Juergens.
No.
Munson.
No.
Pearson.
No.
Poppy.
No.
Pass.
Sock.
The House File 1511, I give 8-5, passes. That motion is, that bill is on its way to Judiciary Finance. I am very sorry about the additional two bills and to the testifiers who were here. Obviously, we have, both of them have to be referred to another committee, so we'll have to move quickly. We'll just have to figure out a reschedule on that. But sorry about that. Meeting is adjourned.